This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday the 24th of March, these are our main stories. More demonstrators and journalists are arrested in Turkey as the authorities say they've detained well over 1,000 people in the past 5 days of protests. Talks between US and Russian negotiators are underway in Saudi Arabia as Donald Trump pushes for a swift end to the war in Ukraine. Israel intensifies its bombardment of Gaza. Palestinian health officials say at least 60 people have been killed in the renewed assault. Also in this podcast... why this comic song has caused a stir about freedom of speech in India. We start in Turkey, where in less than a week, the man seen as the strongest challenger to President Erdogan's decades-long dominance of Turkish politics, Ekrem İmamoğlu, has been arrested, interrogated, jailed and stripped of his position as mayor of Istanbul, sparking some of the biggest protests Turkey has seen in more than a decade. Despite being charged with corruption, he has now officially been nominated as a presidential candidate by the opposition CHP party. Mr. İmamoğlu says the charges against him are politically motivated. A ban on protests failed to deter Turks from taking to the streets in large numbers for a fifth night running to voice their fears for the future of their democracy. Among them, this woman in Istanbul.
There is no such thing as justice in the Republic of Turkey. Absolutely not. I don't believe it. I'm even thinking of leaving the country. I don't want to live here anymore. I mean, I have a beautiful country. I don't want to live in it because people are ruining it.
Since the protests began on Wednesday, the Turkish government says more than 1,100 people have been arrested, including at least 10 journalists detained today in dawn raids. We got this update from Hilkan Boran of the BBC Turkish service, who's in Istanbul.
What we know about the arrest is the official statement from the Interior Minister, Ali Erlikaya, and he has said that more than 1,100 people have been detained, and we know that 123 police officers have been injured throughout these protests from Erlikaya's statements. And as for the morning raids that you mentioned, we know that especially photojournalists appear to have been targeted because they have been reporting on the protests because Turkey's media watchdog has been warning other news organizations to not directly make news of the protests, especially with live broadcasts. So it appears that this might be a targeted operation to prevent people from learning more about the protests. But what we know from the main opposition is that they will be going out in force again into the streets because head of the CHP, Özgür Özel, has called on people to gather in front of the city hall once again. And it remains to be seen whether the number of people who are going out today on the sixth night of consecutive protests will match the previous nights.
And despite the arrest of Mr. İmamoğlu and the fact that he's been charged with corruption, the opposition party that he heads went ahead with its vote to choose him as its presidential candidate with a huge turnout in the primary.
Yes, the primary was actually initially slated only for members of the main opposition party. But after İmamoğlu's arrest on the 19th of March, the head of the main opposition announced that there will be solidarity boxes, ballots being set up so that people who are not party members could also vote. And Özel claimed in a speech yesterday in front of Istanbul City Hall that close to 15 million people have showed up and voted, with just 1.5 million approximately of them being CHP members. And he said that this number of people voting for İmamoğlu puts Erdogan's legitimacy in question, and he has challenged the Turkish president to early elections because normally the elections are slated for 2028.
And there are big questions about whether President Erdogan can contain these protests, especially given the fact that he has had run-ins in the past with the Turkish military.
Of course, this is a thorny subject to talk about because when it comes to Turkey's military history, we know of several coups that have been initiated by the military beforehand. But in today's Turkey, it's a much different picture. Now, the main opposition party has been describing the events since the 19th of March as a political coup against them and against their presidential candidate. But going beyond that, it's really hard to gauge what is going to happen in the coming days. What we know so far is that İmamoğlu's absence, the Istanbul City Council will be gathering on the 26th of March to elect a replacement for İmamoğlu. And because the City Council, the CHP, has the majority in the council, we are expecting a CHP-nominated candidate to take over İmamoğlu's post as he's going through these legal cases.
Hürkan Boran in Istanbul. As we record this podcast, talks between US and Russian officials are underway in Saudi Arabia to try to agree a plan to stop the fighting in Ukraine. It comes a day after the Americans met with the Ukrainian side for discussions that were later described by Ukraine's defense minister as productive and focused. While Ukraine says it's ready for a full truce, Russia's President Vladimir Putin has made it clear that he will seek a wide range of concessions first. The U.S. Special Envoy, Steve Witkoff, told Fox News before the talks that he was optimistic that the Russian leader was interested in ending the conflict.
I feel that he wants peace. The president had two very productive calls this week, or last week, I should say, one with President Zelensky, one with President Putin. I sat and listened to both of them. In both conversations, it was all about a lasting peace.
But this optimism is not shared by Russia itself. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said there were still many outstanding issues to be resolved.
Apparently, we are talking about the desire and willingness of countries to move towards a peaceful settlement. There is indeed a common understanding here. In general, of course, there are still a lot of different aspects related to the settlement to be worked out.
Our security correspondent Frank Gardner is covering the talks in the Saudi capital, Riyadh.
The glittering opulence of Riyadh's Ritz-Carlton Hotel is the venue today for crucial talks aimed at pausing at least aspects of the war in Ukraine. The Russian delegation is on one floor, the Ukrainians, all 25 of them, are on another. The Americans have been meeting both, trying to live up to the rather optimistic expectations of President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff. The Ukrainians say their talks last night were productive. They brought with them technical experts from the Energy Ministry, as well as diplomats and naval officers, to discuss how to safeguard Black Sea shipping lanes. The Russians are keen to revive a moribund deal in the Black Sea, which allowed them to export farm produce and fertilizer in exchange for refraining from attacks on Ukrainian shipping.
Frank Gardner in Riyadh. Before we move on, we have another Q&A with our BBC colleagues from Ukrainecast coming up soon. And we'd like your questions to put to the team. Our email address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. That's globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And if you can, please record your question as a voice note. To Gaza now, where there have been intensified Israeli airstrikes on targets across the territory. The Hamas-run health authority in Gaza says more than 60 people have been killed in the past 24 hours, bringing the number who have died since Israel broke the ceasefire last week to more than 700. Among those killed was a Hamas leader who died in a strike on Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in the south. Israel does not allow foreign journalists to report independently from Gaza, so Emir Nader filed this report from Jerusalem.
Videos show the chaos in the moments after the strike, a floor of the Nasser hospital on fire and a ward destroyed. Ismail Barhum, the head of Hamas's financial department, is understood to have been one of the last two members of the group's political bureau remaining in Gaza. He was receiving treatment for injuries sustained in an earlier strike at the busy hospital's surgery department. Palestinian health officials said a 16-year-old recovering from surgery was among those killed and many others were injured, including medical personnel. The head of the hospital accused Israel of violating all international and humanitarian laws. Israel's Minister of Defense said Barhum had become the new Prime Minister of Gaza in recent days, but Hamas hasn't confirmed this. Israel is expanding its ground and air attacks, with initial reports of numerous deadly raids launched on Monday morning in cities including Rafah and Khan Yunis. On Sunday, health officials announced that the number of Palestinians killed since Israel began its campaign in Gaza has passed 50,000.
Emir Nader. Shortly before we recorded this podcast, one of France's most famous film stars, Gérard Depardieu, arrived at a court in Paris to face sexual assault charges. The 76-year-old is accused of groping two women on a film set 4 years ago. In the past, around 20 women have accused him of sexual assault or abuse. But this is the first case to come to trial. Gérard Depardieu denies all the allegations. Our Paris correspondent, Hugh Schofield, spoke to us from outside the court.
Gerard Depardieu is in the court. He arrived shortly before the session opened, looking okay, but looking his age. Let's not forget that he's also quite ill in the sense that he has a heart condition and diabetes. And that's one reason why this court case was postponed from its original scheduled date, which was in October. And even now, there are sort of special provisions to account for his poor state of health. It's the first time Gerard Depardieu has come to trial after a number of allegations about his behaviour on film sets dating back many, many years. In this particular case, we're talking about a film which was made a few years ago, Sank Without Trace, the film called Les Voles Verts, incidentally about an ageing actor coming to terms with his own declining career. On the set, there were two women who said that they were abused sexually by Gerard Depardieu, that he groped them, that he manhandled them, that he touched their breasts and their buttocks, that one of them complained and said she wanted an apology. She got a kind of apology, but one accompanied by all sorts of lewd language and so on. The defence, that is Gerard Depardieu and his lawyers, contest this totally, say that only one side of the story has been heard so far. I mean, this is a very big story in France. Gerard Depardieu, we know, has been the butt of many, many accusations of sexual misbehaviour, abuse, lewd behaviour, going back some years now. But before that, he was what they call a monstre sacré, a holy monster of cinema. In other words, you know, the most admired and highly regarded of cinema actors of his time. And, I mean, probably the most well-known French male actor around the world, I would say. But, of course, his star fell dramatically when these accusations started coming in the wake of the Me Too movement a few years ago. And now his reputation is a shadow of its former self.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. In Nigeria, more than three quarters of people use skin lightening creams, commonly known as bleaching creams. It's the country with the highest use in Africa, according to the World Health Organization. In 2023, Nigeria's food and drug regulator, NAFDAC, declared a state of emergency over these products. But it's not just adults. There's a worrying trend of parents using the creams on their children, even on babies. Medina Mashanu has been to Kano State, one of several major hubs for skin bleaching in the country, from where she sent this report.
My youngest child was barely 2 years old when I started bleaching him, and the scars have started showing on his skin.
This Nigerian mother used skin lightening creams on all six of her children, which she says burnt their skin. We are concealing her identity for their privacy.
When my daughter was mistaken for a drug addict because of the bleaching, it made me extremely sad.
She says she did it because of pressure from her own mother.
When I visit my mother, she shows more love to her other light-skinned grandchildren. But when I got the bleaching cream and started using it on them, they became lighter, and then she started bringing them closer to her.
Her story is part of a growing trend in Africa, says medical aesthetician and campaigner Zainab Bashiriau.
So a lot of people link light skin to beauty or wealth. Women tend to shield, as they call it, shield their children from that discrimination by bleaching them from childbirth. Some of these women even go to the extent of taking injections while they are pregnant just so they can give birth to lighter skin children.
Long-term use of skin lightening products can have serious consequences.
They can have severe rashes all over their bodies. We've also had cases of, first-degree burn. It can also affect their kidney, which we call the nephrotic syndrome.
Common bleaching ingredients include steroids, mercury, hydroquinone, and kojic acid. Many of these are banned or tightly regulated by Nigeria's food and drug regulator, NAFDAC, especially in children's products.
Despite tight regulations, these bleaching creams are still easily accessible. For example, in this supermarket in Kano State, when I picked up one of the creams that says baby bleaching cream, I noticed that many of the ingredients here are illegal substances.
I met one mother in the market buying bleaching creams for her kids, despite her own hands being discolored by them. Many shopkeepers here, who were not identifying for their safety, mixed their own creams from raw ingredients. It wasn't clear how precisely they were measuring the bleaching chemicals.
We decide the percentage depending on what the customers want. Some want full tablespoon, then sometimes we use baby teaspoon.
Some sellers I spoke to admitted they were not aware of all the NAFDAC rules. NAFDAC has regulated the use of kojic acid. You can now only use a certain percentage. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. But now that you've told me about it, now I know.
I asked NAFDAC what it's doing to educate sellers.
We have done our own sensitization. Many of them, all those people from the market, this one, they came. And they asked questions. I was there. And I also made the presentation to them on the dangers of all these things.
Why isn't NAFDAC doing enough? Since sensitization is clearly not working.
Our officers are already gathering intelligence. Once we are ready to strike, we will strike.
With so many producers and such high demand, the challenges are vast.
What happened to me is why I want to advise other people not to follow this route. They will regret it. You need to accept how God created you.
For this message to be heard, it needs to break through deeply entrenched views on skin color. Until it does, the health of many children may yet be put at risk.
That report from Nigeria by Medina Mashainu. Still to come.
I wouldn't say that Ramadan is difficult. It's more mental because personally, I'm used to doing it. It's more the lack of water.
How one Premier League footballer copes while fasting during Ramadan. You're listening to the Global News Podcast. It's the latest twist in the months of political turmoil that have rocked South Korea since its president, Yoon Suk-yeol, briefly declared martial law last December. This led to him being impeached, as was the man who became acting president, the Prime Minister Han Duck-soo. Now Mr. Han's impeachment has been dismissed by a constitutional court, which has reinstated him as South Korea's acting president. Mr. Han, unsurprisingly, welcomed the ruling.
I am grateful for the wise decision by the Constitutional Court. Above all else, I want to thank the former acting president Choi Sang-mok and cabinet members for leading the country during the suspension of my duty. I will tend to the most urgent matters.
The court found no proof that Mr. Han had played an active role in approving the short-lived martial law declared by President Yoon. There's now speculation that Mr. Yoon's impeachment could also be overturned soon. Our Asia Pacific editor is Mickey Bristow.
There's a lot of complications to this story. Essentially, it began back in December when the president, Yoon Suk-yeol, declared martial law. He tried to declare martial law. He was impeached, removed from office a week later, and into the breach stepped Han Duck-soo. He became acting president. He was the prime minister, became acting president. But then he too was removed from office, impeached by the National Assembly. And so a third politician had to step into the role as acting president. What the Constitutional Court has done today is to say that Mr. Han should not have been removed from office as acting president, and they've reinstated him. So he's gone straight back to the office, resumed duties, as you heard there. He thanked the judges. So still a lot of change, still a lot of upheaval. We've got an acting president back in office in the shape of Mr. Han.
But at the same time, we've still got the president being impeached, who briefly declared martial law at the end of last year. Will the verdict in the case of Mr. Han have any bearing on Mr. Yoon's case?
Yeah, this court ruling today is essentially a sideshow, a minor event compared to the big event, which is the Constitutional Court's decision on whether to endorse the impeachment of the president, Yoon Suk-yeol, for declaring martial law. It was possible that today's ruling could have indicated which way the judges were thinking. But in actual fact, what they did, they were looking narrowly at whether Mr. Han, the acting president, had been involved in martial law. They decided that he had nothing to do with that. So essentially, it doesn't really give as much of an indication of how they're going to rule in the bigger decision on Mr. Yoon's impeachment. Now, that's expected. Well, it was expected already. Some people thought it was going to come mid-March. It hasn't. And so a lot of people now are trying to work out what it is the judges are thinking, want them to get on and make this decision. Because as long as this decision isn't made, the political turmoil and chaos in South Korea continues. Once they've made the decision on Mr. Yoon, he will either go back to being president or he will be dismissed permanently and there'll be new elections within 2 months. So it's only this next court case which will see the beginning at the end of the political turmoil in South Korea.
Mickey Bristow. The once popular American DNA testing firm 23andMe has filed for bankruptcy protection and announced the resignation of its CEO and co-founder Anne Wojcicki. The company says it will now attempt to sell itself under the supervision of a court. This comes 6 months after the firm settled a lawsuit alleging it failed to protect the privacy of nearly 7 million customers whose personal information was exposed in a 2023 data breach. Our North America technology correspondent, Lily Jamali, told us more.
This company was really premised on the idea that you could spit into a test tube and learn a whole lot about your ancestry as well as potential health risks. And it was a product that really resonated with customers, certainly. They had a whole bunch of celebrity endorsements early on. And it also resonated with investors who took the value of this company up to $6 billion at one point. It has now fallen by about 98, 99%. It's lost that much value. They're going into Chapter 11 in the hopes that they will be able to sell the company through a court-supervised process. But the company's saying that, you know, for now, not much changes. It stays in operations. But I can tell you that on Friday, just a couple days ago, going into this announcement of this Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection situation that they're now in, the Attorney General of California actually issued a consumer alert here in our state saying that people can delete their data to protect it because there's so much uncertainty about the company's financial situation now.
Lily Jamali. Now to India. Where the comedian singing this parody song is being investigated for possible defamation for joking about an Indian state leader who is an ally of the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. It's just the latest case in India that raises questions about freedom of speech. Police in the western city of Mumbai opened an investigation against Kunal Kamra over his comedy skit following a complaint filed by a politician from the state leader's party after supporters were angered by the use of the word traitor. The venue where the comedian performed was reportedly ransacked. Our correspondent in Delhi, Arunaday Mukherjee, told us more.
This comedian was performing at a venue in the city of Mumbai where he made those comments, which you heard, vis-a-vis that song. Multiple police complaints following that have been filed against the comic for making those references. Now, there is a background to this, and that is that the target of the Comedy Act is the current Deputy Chief Minister of the state of Maharashtra, the capital of which is the city of Mumbai. Now, this person had rebelled against his party and then formed a breakaway one which allied with the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party belonging to Prime Minister Narendra Modi, which is why the reference to a traitor was made by this comedian. Now, this is essentially why you're seeing this kind of controversy erupt. We saw the supporters going ahead and protesting. Now, the old party to which this politician belonged to has come out in support of the comedian, while the new party, along with the ruling BJP, continues to criticise this comedian. And also, as I mentioned, police cases have been filed.
And has there been any response from the comedian?
Not yet. We haven't heard from him as yet. I've been trying to track his social media accounts, but we haven't heard him say anything at the moment. But in the past, this comedian has had similar run-ins with the ruling establishment and authorities. He's had police cases, court cases against him. So this is not new. And usually, if history is to be seen, he is usually seen to have brazened these out even in the past. And he's, he's quite well known in the comedy circles as someone who has always taken on the ruling establishment with satire.
I mean, there have been reports that the comedy venue has been ransacked, and this all comes at a time of growing concern in India about freedom of speech and intimidation of the media.
Absolutely. And I think that is the point that is also being reported. Angry supporters of the party yesterday went on a rampage at this studio where the comments were actually made. This was, according to them, a sign of their protest and anger. Visuals that we've seen on social media and local television channels showed that the supporters were swinging chairs and damaging cameras and lights at the studio where these comments were made. They've also warned for more protests if action is not taken against the comedian. You have to understand that this is a party which is currently in alliance with the BJP, currently governing the state of Maharashtra. So the police, in a way, is directly answerable to this government. So it would be interesting to see how the police actually acts. But like you pointed out, there have been cases against comedians, artists, actors for expressing dissent, for hurting
sentiments of another community. It's been a polarizing issue. One side always says freedom of speech is guaranteed in the Indian constitution, while the other side says that it should not be abused. And even in this case, the current chief minister has said that freedom of speech is not absolute and it cannot encroach on others' freedom either.
Arunade Mukherjee. In recent years, elite-level sport has started doing more to help professional Muslim athletes who observe the holy month of Ramadan. The Premier League is a good example, introducing pauses in play that allow players to break their fast if the sun sets during a game. But it's not easy to play football without eating or drinking during daylight hours. Our reporter Ian Williams has been speaking to one Premier League star about his faith.
The call to prayer, a sound familiar to Muslims across the world. During Ramadan, the holy month in which followers believe the Quran was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, spiritual reflection becomes even more important. Such as for those bowing in prayer here at Poole Mosque on England's south coast. But among the regular worshippers is someone recognisable to millions, someone who has travelled a long way from home and who finds familiarity in faith.
My name is Dango Ouattara. I was born in Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso. I play football for Bournemouth in the Premier League. For me, faith comes first. It comes before football. Faith allows me to overcome many challenges, to respect others, to be stable in everything I do. Whether it's on the pitch or off it, it allows me to be calm in my daily life.
As Dango poses for photographs, it's clear that his quiet, unassuming nature is at odds with the stereotype of the flashy Premier League player.
Thank you for coming.
The 23-year-old winger arrived in Bournemouth from French side Lorient just over 2 years ago. But until today's visit, some at the mosque still didn't know they had such a famous member of their family. And for Dango, who left Africa 5 years ago as a teenager, that family has been important.
When you find yourself in another town, having the community shows that you are not alone. And as I came to the mosque, everything went well for me with the football.
One of only four Burkinabes to play in the English top flight, he's certainly been hungry for goals, scoring 9 times in 30 appearances this season for the Cherries. But as we settle down cross-legged on the mosque carpet, I wanted to know how fasting affects him.
I wouldn't say that Ramadan is difficult. It's more mental, because personally, I'm used to doing it. It's more the lack of water.
And what do you do to try and get round it? I think you get up early, is that correct?
I wake up at 4:30 a.m. I do my ablutions and I've already got the food, which has been prepared by the club chef. Then I go back to bed for an hour or so. Then, after training, I say my prayers and I sleep for another hour. Everyone asks me, how are you feeling? Is it going well? They try to understand me and not demand too much, even though I still try to do my sessions as usual.
As the afternoon ticks by, more people arrive and do their ablutions before praying. They're beginning to look forward to the iftar, the meal which breaks their fast at sundown. Farooq Talukta is the mosque secretary.
Ramadan brings you closer to God. Also, you gain self-control. And also, you are aware of the unfortunate people. Brings the community closer. Yeah, we are very happy and we are very proud to have someone like Dango to come here as a part of our family.
For Dango, the feeling is mutual.
You have the opportunity to pray with other people, to meet new people. It keeps us focused on religion.
In his new home in England, faith has brought stability and routine, helping to turn Dango into a success on the pitch, someone who Bournemouth fans also have faith in.
That report by Ian Williams. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is, of course, globalpodcast@globalnews.com. bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Chantal Hartle. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jannat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.